Hello, and welcome along to the Colchester Arts Centre's Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name's Tim Morgan, and, well, we're going to have some fun in a minute. So hopefully you enjoyed last month's edition, the Blurcast, where we got to talk to lots and lots of excited fans and some of the crew and some other surprises. And this month, it's just as exciting. We're going to be talking everything Blockheads, specifically Ian Dury and the Blockheads, and the Blockheads returning, well, on an annual basis to Colchester Arts Centre, every year for sell-out gigs. And, I was very, very lucky to catch up with Chaz Jankel and talk about all things Ian Dury, and a little bit about his solo career as well. Absolutely fascinating. So, without further ado, let's talk to Chaz. I hope you enjoy this.
Can I ask you, so the Blockheads, so how did that come about? So you met Ian Dury. Was that when he was, what, Kilburn of the High Roads, or?
Yeah, so, you know, he was the singer of Ian and the Kilburns, and that was the last lineup of Kilburn and the High Roads.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had bought a Wurlitzer piano, and from Maurice Plaquet in Shepherd's Bush music shop. And I said to the manager on my leaving, I gave him a little scrap of paper and I said, this is my telephone number. If anybody needs a keyboard player, tell them to give me a call. And the next day, the guitar player, Ed Spate, went into the shop. He was mates with the manager. And as they were chatting, he said, and he also said their keyboard player just left. The Kilburns. And so the manager said, this bloke came in yesterday. He left his telephone number. Give him a call. So I got the call and I went down to the Greyhound in Fulham Palace Road the next night where they were doing a gig. I was invited by Ed. And I went down to the gig and I watched like I was hypnotized by this very loud, zany group. And at the end of the gig, of their performance, I jumped up on the stage like an over-eager mid-20s bloke that I was and rushed down towards the dressing room. I saw down the tunnel they went that led from the dressing room to the stage, and a roadie was still on stage. And he said, Ian, mate, where are you going? He said, if you want to see the band, you go around the front way. So I duly obliged. I hopped off the stage, went round to the side entrance, followed round. Now I'm behind the stage and I saw this dressing room and it looked like a Turkish bath. It was all steam coming out of it. And in the middle of it was one bloke, he had his eye on the door. Guess who? Ian Dury. And he saw me approaching. And just as I was about to go to the door, he said, "Here, mate, do I know you? Well, F off then." See, I was ahead, you know. And I was perplexed. I didn't know what to do. Anyway, I turned around and I was about to leave, you know, feeling very uncomfortable. And the guitar player and Ed Spate said, "Oh, hello, mate." He said, "Are you Chaz?" And I went, "Yeah." He went, "Oh, nice to meet you." So, and then they had a rehearsal the next day and things got better from there. I mean, I passed the audition, got the gig, excuse me. And at that point, they just knew I played, or Ian and the band only saw me playing electric piano. They didn't know I played guitar.
Yeah.
And that took a little while before I introduced that to the band.
And how did you sort of becoming part of that change the sound? Because I would say maybe your sound is more from a kind of funkier kind of perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. So Tim, really what I would say is that Ian's, the performance I had seen the night before I passed the audition was kind of rockabilly with a small R, kind of, you know, kind of very kind of, what I say, earthy kind of songwriting. It wasn't one thing or another, but it certainly wasn't funky or soulful in that respect. But my love really had always been as much as The Who, as The Small Faces, Free, The Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, all of that. was part, had been part of my life. But during my teens, particularly my latter teens, I'd been getting into Afro-American music big time. And I really connected with it. And so that was, I suppose, the influence I brought to Ian. And Ian loved it because, he loved rhythm. Ian was a great drummer. And so he loved it. It's just that no one in the band before that was wanted to kind of stand up. And maybe they didn't like that kind of music. Maybe they weren't into it. But I know Ian ruled like a kind of like a gang boss. So he probably directed the way the music went. And often as the lyricist, you know, I noticed as I wrote songs with Ian, he wrote in rhyming couplets, which really determines the rhythm often of a song. You know, if that is the way a song is initiated, often rhythm is, you know, plays a second fiddle to that, or it accompanies it. It's a very solid beat. Whereas if you start from a riff or a bass line or a drum beat, you've got a lot more room to expand upon, you know. And then the lyric sits inside this lovely kind of cocoon of rhythm. And that's what we develop more, actually. But at the same time, I realised, sorry, you probably wanted sound clips, but this is a long sound clip. Thanks, Tim. At the same time, you know, I always acknowledged that Ian's love was musical as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we kept, you know, and why would I want to diminish that? And I didn't. And so your Billy Ricky Dickies got in there, your Clever Trevors, which was a kind of hybrid, really, of kind of a funky beat, and then this, you know, fella that Ian had conjured up. And then I suppose on the tail end of New Boots and Panties, you had, you know, Plasto, Patricia and Blackmail Man, which was really Ian's kind of brilliant observation and kind of compassion for the disenfranchised, really. And in Plasto Patricia, I'd say that was true. Blackmail Man was just Ian's observation of the way, the wicked ways of people. Yeah.
And with the kind of writing, was it the lyrics first, and did that inform the rhythm, or was it the other way round? Or,
well, that's, you know, this is what I was kind of hinting at, really. I mean, to start with, I would follow Ian's lyrics, but, you know, the more confidence Ian had in me, the more I would just suggest riffs to him. So, for example, Wake Up, I just started Wake Up and Make Love. I just, boom, boom, ta-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I had that, and Ian built his lyric around that. Whether he had... Oh, so sorry. 1 second.
That's my lord.
Sorry, Mike, I'm doing a podcast. I'll just speak later. Bye-bye. 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 Oh, fuck. He wants to have a 3-minute conversation. I'm saying bye-bye, you know. That was our lead singer, Mike Bennett. Very nice bloke. Great. He's doing great. You're probably going to come on to him soon.
Yeah.
But, where were we, Tim? I've lost
the thread. We were talking about kind of the lyrics and informing how the kind of rhythm is sort of developed from that.
Yeah,
and...
you know, I mean, as I say, it started off with Ian writing the lyrics first, and then very soon after that, I would suggest riffs or rhythms.
Yeah.
And then Ian would apply himself to that. And it freed him up. It freed him up because he could be more succinct with his lyrics. Because Ian was very prolific, and he would write reams and reams and loads of verses, and often my role would actually be editor, you know, like, you can't have those many verses, Ian, that would take 3 days for this song to finish, you know. So often I'll just take the first 3 verses, and I reckon, well, that's what he really wanted to say, you know, those were probably the most important. And so they were edited versions a lot of the time of these pages of lyrics that he'd written.
And when you kind of recorded New Boots and Panties, did you realise at the time how it was going to kind of connect with people? And I mean, you know, we're many, many years on, and this is, you know, it's just an absolute classic album, isn't it? And it is a one of a kind, because there wasn't really anything like
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, to be honest, I had no idea. I thought that I knew it was different. And yeah. at that time, there was no bands just, you know, hopping over the barriers of genre. Let's put it like that. You know, the kind yeah. of the fences of genres. Nobody was doing that. I didn't know anybody. I've noticed that of late, over the last few years, you get bands like the Kings of Leon, or there are other bands that, you know, like mix up their genres. Ian, I never even heard him say the word genre. You know, I don't think yeah. he wasn't, what's the word? Captured or what's the word? Restricted, sorry.
Yeah.
He wasn't restricted by genre. And all I did as a musician oftentimes would just kind of paint the right picture for his lyric. Or if I thought, you know, hey, Ian, check it. Why don't we play around with a rhythm like this or a riff? Because of his love of rhythm, and he was, as I said, a very good drummer. And at one point he started even programming drum machines in the latter part of his life. Mm. He loved rhythm. So he would adapt to that. You know, and he would sit his lyric on top of the beat.
And I suppose this is, so obviously when you lost Ian, in, you know,
the 2000. Yeah.
How was it with, because obviously you had the album where you went back and revisited some of the, I guess they were works in progress for the sort of 10 more turnips from yeah. the tip. How was that going into the studio? Because obviously without Ian being there.
It was strange. I mean,
because did you feel you didn't have that person to bounce the ideas back? And it was kind of, did you feel that, not obligation, that's the wrong word, but did you feel that you had to kind of service it?
Yeah, it was a very, very strange time.
Yeah.
Very strange time. In fact, Dance Little Rude Boy was a song yeah. that we performed quite a long time when Derek the Draw, who was our, you know, who'd been our singer ever since Ian passed away till he passed away about a year ago, just over a year yeah. ago. We used to play, now and again, we would play Dance Little Rude Boy, which is one of my favourite songs on the album. Also, You're the Why that Robbie Williams sang.
Yeah.
On the Why. I mean, I love that song. And you know, I mean, there was some great material on that album. It was weird, as you say. It was weird finishing off the album without the guy who'd started it, you know, who was central to everything. You know, even when I do gigs now, I try to remember to remind the audience that if it wasn't for Ian, we wouldn't be here. You know, yeah. none of us would be here. It's been a long journey, you know. You know, his spirit is right there, you know, right in the mix of everything. So, I'm very grateful for that.
And I was going to ask that, because I can imagine that you have that sense that he's always there, because obviously within the music, he's there. And I think with the audience, they have a really deep connection with the songs.
Yeah, they do. It's incredible. I was actually chatting to Mickey Gallagher's, who's the other keyboard player in the band, and as you yeah. probably know, and, you know, I was talking to his granddaughter, and, you know, she's near at the age where I don't want to push this on her, but she if she was to have a child, right, then there'd be four generations of, you know, of Blockhead fans, so to speak. I mean, I've seen three generations. I've seen granddad, son, his son, and then his son standing there in their Blockhead t-shirts at our gigs. It's a lovely story. I mean, I make this joke that the day that William Shakespeare stopped acting in his own plays, it's been tribute acts ever since. and I think that will be the story of us. I mean, the music will transcend the members in the band, you know.
Yes.
What a lovely thing. You know, that will be probably, you know, part of my legacy will be, you know, being involved with in that album, and then the continuing story, because that album allowed, you know, at that point, Mickey Gallagher and Johnny Turnbull weren't in the band. It was just that first album was with Norman Watroy and Charlie Charles. Now, the four of them, with Mickey and Johnny, were part of a band called Loving Awareness. And when Ian and I sort of finished recording New Boots and Panties, his management wanted us to go and do some gigs. And we said, would you come with us? And they said, only if we can bring the rest of our band. Because even though they were Loving Awareness, they weren't doing a lot of gigs. They were sort of recording. And, you know, I think they needed a release from that. And they were happy to come on the road. So we went on. So they said, yeah, we'll come. And then Ian brought Davey Payne, who was a sax player from Cuban the High Roads and other sort of musical formations he'd had. And that became the Blockheads for about 20 years. Ian during the Blockheads for about 20 years. So that was a whole story in itself, a whole journey. And then when Derek joined, in when Ian passed, and then Derek started singing, he'd been Ian's minder, Derek the drawer. But he loved Ian's lyrics. Phil Jupitus did do a couple of gigs with us, and he was brilliant. And he loved Ian's lyrics. He was a huge fan. And then Derek carried on, and up until last year, he's been singing. And I've actually written three albums with him since Ian passed away. And, you know, he was a genius lyricist in his own way as well. Yeah.
And Will, I mean, because I think you did, was it Staring Down the Barrel? Was that the first one? Yeah. And then the last one was Beyond the Call of Duty, I think. Is there gonna be another Blockheads album, or will it just organically happen if it happens?
Well, I shouldn't let the cat out the bag, but I'm going to. I'm in the process of writing a single with Mike Bennett, who has become our lead singer of late. Yeah. And so whether that actually materializes or not is yet to be seen. But he's really thrown himself, you know, into action, and he's, you know, he's really committed himself to singing and learning the lyrics of the Dewey Jankel songbook. Yeah. And so I thought, you know what, it'd be nice for him to, because he writes loads. He's very prolific. And so we started writing a song. Yeah. So I think it's the continuing story, really, of the Blockheads.
And how do you fit it all in? Because obviously you've got your kind of solo stuff as well, and you've recently had an album come out in May, wasn't it? Flow.
Yeah. Just take a listen. It's got some funky stuff on there.
I was listening on Juno earlier on, so I had a bit of a listen to it. So I need to go back and explore it properly. It sounded very funky. So
it's got its own. Yeah, it's got its own energy. Yeah.
And will you be doing some tours solo-wise at some point?
I'd like to think I'm going to. I keep putting it off, but I think this period of my life should be one of consolidation, and included in that would actually be going out and doing some gigs. You know, I mean. I've become very comfortable singing with the Blockheads and working with the Blockheads. And, it's like I'm playing with my mates. And we've been so fortunate because the audiences have loved everything we've done. You know, I mean, it's really has all those years. Somehow we there's something in those songs that makes people very happy. And so if I go out doing my stuff, I'd like to think that, you know, it could be at least if it was 60% of that, I'd be very happy. Yeah. And it's just a question of having the confidence and being ready to commit to it. Because a lot of the time, you know, I'm not center stage in the Blockheads. I'm very happy just off to the left or stage left, I think is what you'd call it. I'm happy there, but I have. So I did try doing did a gig at the Jazz Cafe in 2011, where I had a 14-piece band. And I did my songs. I played my songs, a lot of which actually were written with Ian. I there was a big song I had in the States called Glad to Know You. Then I had another song which was in a movie called Mike's Murder called Number One that Ian wrote the lyric for. And, you know, so we did write a lot together. And that was part of it. So I could do it, but I needed that one gig. I lost about 1,800 quid. And that hurt my fingers a little bit. But I thought, yay, I've done it. But I also got frozen shoulder at the end of it through carrying so much gear.
Carrying so everything.
I get some assistance. If I'm going to do it, I need a bit of a, I'll need a helping hand.
Yeah. And can I just ask you as well? So with your first solo album, which was, I think, 1980. Yes. And then, so the start, the first track on that then appeared.
Yeah.
Quincy Jones did it and it appeared a year late. How did that come about?
Yeah.
Because it was a massive hit, wasn't it?
It was a massive hit. What happened was, I wrote the song with a guy called Kenny Young, a songwriter called Kenny Young. He wrote the lyric and I wrote the music and the melody. And so I had my record deal was with A&M Records. And there was a girl working at A&M who heard my single when in the office and played it to her boyfriend, who was Johnny Turnbull in the Blockheads.
Yeah.
And they were friends with Rod Temperton and his girlfriend. They met, had dinner one night and they played him the song, this record. They must have snuck it out of A&M because it wasn't released that long. Anyway, they played it to Rod and Rod said, oh, we're looking for two more songs for the Dude album. He was writing and producing with Quincy. Yeah. It was Quincy's last album for A&M. And that's how, they heard it. Quincy heard it. And then one day I get this crackly little call from the States. Hello, is that Chaz Jankel? And I went, yeah. They said, hello, I'm Quincy Jones' secretary. We wanted to know, would you mind if Quincy records I Know Corita? It was one of those, I thought it was a prank call. But anyway, I said, no, I don't mind. You know, that's okay. And it went from there. Yeah. And the upside was I got to meet Quincy, a while later in his Bel Air mansion. He was a really nice guy. And he said to me, hey, Jazz, what are you doing tomorrow night? And this was back in 81 or whenever it was. And I said, well, not a lot. He said, well, look, he said, Michael's playing at the, at the this huge gig. I can't remember what the gig was, massive arena. He said, Mike, well, we know Michael. And I said, he said, you're like, oh, yeah. So we both this massive, I've never seen such a big arena in my life. I can't remember what it's called in LA. And my musical hero was sitting right behind me, Sly Stone. We didn't talk about it, but Sly and the Family Stone were they were the go-to guys for me when I was in my early 20s. And loved, the way I loved the soul, but yet the breadth of all the music they were making. So one half, I had to stop looking over my shoulder because I thought you might think I'm a stalker. Right. And then, but anyway, so then I saw this incredible show of Michael Jackson and his brothers. And that was a highlight for me when I was over there. Yeah.
So what's next? So you've got a new album and you may or may not tour. There's possibly going to be
Well, I'd like to think, well, we'll see if that happens. I mean, this isn't necessarily for the podcast because this is all about. Actually, funny enough, I did do a gig with my jazz, a quartet I put together in about 2000, early 2000s, played it in Colchester Arts Centre. And both my sons were there, but they didn't hear one note. They were in the office playing computer games, quite happy. And when the gig was over, I said, right, come on, let's go. And we sort of all trotted out the hall together. So a large part of me likes working in with instrumental music. And I've actually just completing two albums with two different very, very talented musicians. And one is with a cellist.
Yeah.
His name's Frank Schaefer. And he's worked on over 600 movies. He's working on all kinds of big movies. He's actually worked on the Joni Mitchell album as well. So that's been amazing. And I'm just finishing that. And then there's another album I'm making with a duduk player, which is an ancient Armenian.
Middle Eastern.
It's like a clarinet, but we've made an album together. And it's so they're kind of quite meditative, really, in a way. The music is quite sort of quite soulful. Yeah, so I can't put all my eggs in one basket. That's the thing.
Are you always writing? Are you always kind of, do you always have an idea?
Well, when I don't, I think something's wrong.
Yeah.
But no, it's not true. I mean, actually, as I get older, I just like to, you know, make sure I'm getting enough sunshine, getting vitamin D, you know, because nature can make you feel so good, generally speaking, in this country. You know, you just go out, you breathe air, and you don't feel restricted, you feel connected, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then you go into your little kind of room and start working, and you've got to be careful you don't just dislocate yourself from that feeling of oneness, so to speak. You know, I feel that, and so just I sometimes if I'm in working, I'll just get out my room, because I work in my garden retreat studio. It's a fancy name for a shed at the bottom of the garden. But it works for me. I have a very short journey to work, you know, about six paces to the back door, you know. It's really good. I love it. So but as I say, I like to make sure that I'm not cutting myself off from the source of life, so to speak, because it's very easy to do that, you know. You can go into your own space, but how does it connect? And I think it, you know, I'm kind of conscious of that, you know, like this amazing gift we've been given, actually, life. I'm sort of, you know, enjoying that. So I think 50% of what I do is making the music, but the other 50% is getting it out there, letting people hear it.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? Georgia O'Keeffe said, apparently, success means nothing. What it does mean something is making the unknown known.
That's making very wise.
Making your unknown known. So,
yeah.
And I find that lovely, because isn't it great when you talk to people and you don't know anything about them, and the more they talk, you sort of like go into their world. You suddenly
absolutely get into their world. Yeah. And I think that's really fascinating, isn't it? Because it's kind of, you get a different perspective, really, I think, completely. So,
and thank you to Chaz for taking time out and speaking to me. It was a real pleasure and a genuinely lovely fellow. And if you got along to the Blockheads gig, I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back again next month. If you're listening on the Colchester Arts Centre podcast and you'd like to hear a little bit more, you can pop over to Mixcloud if you'd like to hear the tunes that were also played. And if you're listening on Mixcloud, I hope you enjoyed those tunes. And once again, this is the Colchester Arts Centre Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name's Tim Morgan, and I'll see you again next month with some more, well, hopefully rather exciting things. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate it.